champion becomes a legend. Mackay Deaver has won it.
Perkins goes in first. What a legend. What a champion.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
And it's great to have you with us for the second instalment of our special feature episode with Peter Gordon, the Western Bulldogs president for Tobin Brothers Funerals. This Is Your Sporting Life. Last week, we covered a lot of ground with Peter. We spoke about the saving of the club, some of the great names around the club as well. In this edition, of course, we talk about that famous day in 2016 and a lot more with the Western Bulldogs president.
He's only kicked 7 goals in his short career. If he makes it 8 here, this will bring the house down. Zane Cordy! Listen to that for a roar on grand final day at the MCG.
We've spoken about the fact that there are two stints at the helm. 2012, you've already explained your reasons why you came back in 2012, but the club was about to face a difficult period. The coach was going to go. The captain was going to go, not too far down the track. It was crisis time again in the eyes of a lot of people.
It's funny. I was negotiated with, I guess, by a lot of people at the club. Leading it was David Smorgon, who really wanted me to take the job back on. And I nearly said no. In fact, I did say no to him and to Simon Garlick, who was the CEO at the time, and to Chris Grant, mainly because I had for the past 2 or 3 years been doing a class action for people with thalidomide birth defects, which is a 50-year-old birth defect drug, and I'd become really passionate about it, and really I'd started up Gordon Legal just to do that case, and I felt like it was a year away, so I put him off, but he was pretty persistent, David, and got me into doing it. One of the reservations that I had about it was I'd been at the helm when two coaches were replaced. One of them was Terry, who I sacked, Terry Wheeler, and then there was Alan Joyce standing down in 1996, and Terry Wallace taking over, and that knocked me around a lot. So in a lot of my discussions with both Simon Garlick and Chris Grant, I was honest with them and said I really don't want to be in that sort of position again. And they both said to me, look, unlike those times, you've got us there, and we have extensive experience in football, and we're happy to take up that part of it. And so that seemed like a good idea at the time. And 18 months into it, of course, in the second half of 2014, there emerged dramatically at the end of the season for us problems between then-captain Ryan Griffin and Brendan McCartney. And as it turned out, those problems had started to emerge in mid-2014. And I was kind of, I guess, talking to both Chris and Simon about that as events unfolded. And I guess I eventually got to the point as that was going on, and particularly after, you know, Ryan Griffin announced that he was leaving, and the club was sort of plunged into that sort of crisis of thinking to myself, there's a decision to be made about the coach here. There's a decision to be made about the football department, and it's not something where I can say, well, you know what, I'm going to be president for everything except this. If you're in, you've got to be all in. And so I reluctantly put myself into that situation again, and we navigated that outcome. Brendan left, went off to become an assistant coach at Melbourne, and we were left at the end of 2014 with no captain and no coach. And it seems odd that it was less than 2 years later that we won the premiership. But it was a really difficult. It was a really difficult period. I remember that Rob Murphy, I think, was in Bali with his wife Justine and with a few other people. We only got a chance to talk about it, about the events when he got back. We went for a long walk, and he was sort of expressing his disbelief. You know, there were some internet problems with. He read something about Ryan Griffin. He read enough to know that, you know, it was bad news, but. And he was sort of recounting all of that. And then as we sort of got about a mile from my place, I said to him, I just wanted to understand How come your name's never come up in terms of captaincy before? And he said, well, look, the truth of it is it's kind of never emerged because at the time, at every time I've been at the club, they've always been great captains. When I was first at the club, Scott Wynde was captain. He's one of the great captains of all time. And then, of course, after him, there was Chris Grant. And Chris Grant, you know, is a great leader. And then, you know, Brad Johnson and then Matthew Boyd. And then, you know, Macca just announced to us that Ryan Griffin was taking over the captaincy. So it's not as if I've ever had a discussion with anyone like I'm having this discussion with you now. But now that we are having this conversation, let me just make it clear. I really want it now, and I think that I am the person that needs to do this job. And I'm not saying it on my own account. I'm saying it because that's what the club needs. The club at this stage needs me to be captain.
Did that surprise you when he came out and said that?
Look, I really wanted him to be captain. I think it wasn't a complex decision. It seemed to me like happy to take credit for supporting it, but it wasn't as, you know, I think that Dal Morris was a perfectly plausible candidate for it, but with due respect to Moz, to me, Murph was the obvious candidate. What did surprise me was he'd actually been in my lounge room 3 weeks earlier when we'd first heard, not that Griff was leaving, but that Griff had these serious problems with Brendan McCartney that he had only just asked to see me about and told me about. And I told Simon Garlick about it immediately, and we decided to talk to Murph and to Daniel Janser Accuser about it. And they came over and they sat on my couch looking stunned and sort of, well, you know, I mean, we knew there were a few issues, but we didn't know it was anything like this. And but boy, if Griff feels like that, that's pretty serious. And I reflect on that. In the course of, like, what, 3-4 weeks, he had gone from, I'm shocked by this, and but haven't really noticed anything in particular, to, like, grabbing ownership of the problem and the issue and the challenge by the scruff of the neck and saying, I'm going to make this my mission to fix. So it wasn't that I was surprised that he wanted to be captain. I was surprised, but in a really good way, at the way in which he was approaching the challenge.
Just with regards to the Brendan McCartney situation, obviously it's pretty serious if the captain can't get on with the coach. But was it just him, or did the floodgates then open once Ryan Griffin had come out and said, I've got these issues? Was then that followed by a litany of supporting evidence?
Yeah, there are a few players. Let me say this. I think that football does involve the suspension of disbelief amongst everyone. I think that in every club there are probably a spectrum of players who feel various ways about coaches, and I think when the circumstances, you know, bring the whole thing into that sort of florid public display like that, then anyone who's got any kind of grievance is going to use the situation. But I think that Griff's rather dramatic announcement did spur on, well, clearly did spur on a number of other players and a number of other issues, and Brendan himself acknowledged that, and he was, I think, decent enough to acknowledge a couple of years later that the club had actually made the right move in replacing him with Bevo, which was a generous thing to Simon. It was obviously after the premiership, but you know, look, those situations are difficult, and it's hard to know what to do. You would certainly like to preside over an environment where if a captain had those sort of issues, you got to hear about him a little earlier than when he kind of it had reached such a stressful, difficult and point of no return position for Ryan that it obviously had. You know, I think it's fair to say that from the first time I knew about it, which was the morning after the Best and Fairest, it was done. You know, it was kind of irredeemable. And despite the best efforts of myself and Chris Grant and Macca, it wasn't redeemable. I don't think, and I think he would say this himself, I don't think Griff ever wanted to be captain. And I think that Macca saw an opportunity in him, had a vision of what he might be able to achieve because of his on-field prowess, his ability to inspire with his deeds on the field, that probably misunderstood the essential shyness of his nature. I mean, I think captaincy of a club requires deeds on the field, but it also requires certain abilities to speak and represent and behave in a particular way off the field. And I don't think Griff, certainly at that time, was particularly thrilled with those aspects of the job.
As you intimated before, if someone had come along to you at that stage and said, well, you're going to win a flag in a couple of years' time, you probably would have been calling for the men in the white coats. But as it turns out, that's the path the football club took. So let's fast forward to September 2016. I spoke about this with Bob when he was in here a couple of weeks ago. The first final is in Perth. You've been flogged over in Perth 2 weeks before. First year of the bye comes in. You make five changes. Did you go over there thinking that you were going to beat the West Coast Eagles because they didn't think that you were going to beat them?
I listened to that podcast with Bob and heard him say that he was absolutely confident. I didn't share that confidence. I'd been in the rooms after the Geelong game where both Jackson McRae and Tom Liberatore had suffered injuries. And I remember Gary Zimmerman, you know, one of our club doctors, saying to me about Libba, he's no chance to play for the rest of the season. But we're not going to tell him that because we want to really keep him focused and, you know, for his rehab and his redevelopment next year. But you can write him off. And with Jackson, you know, look, we'd need to go deep into September. So that was the mindset I took about those two guys. And when I started to hear, and I think it was from Ben Graham that I first heard early in the week of the West Coast game, that they were both going to be available to play, I was shocked. I think I actually called Bevo and said, is this right? No, I didn't. Sorry, I called Jake Landsberg, the other club doctor. And he said, yeah, it is. He said, it's not just me, but it's mainly me as club doctor. Who's, it was remarkable that those guys could come up. And they both, of course, played spectacular games. It's an intimidating environment, Perth. And games started with, you know, massive sort of Thunderdome-type support for the West Coast Eagles, but it was clear by quarter time that the players had a particular mindset about that game. And I recall in particular the sort of intensity at the ball of Liam Picken and Tom Liberatore, and it was remarkable. And I know, well, you remember that game, but there's a moment in the third quarter, I think, where Jordan Ruffhead grabs the ball, storms towards the 50-metre line and boots it through from about 55 metres out to put us about four or five goals in front, where emphatically the whole world needs to look. You know, this is not just some aberration where the Bulldogs have got their nose in front. They're going to win this game.
So all of a sudden the Bulldogs could be an MCG final.
That'll be fascinating. Lysett ran over the top of it. Dogs, another clearance and a rough hit. Takes the mark, turns and goes from 50. And if the icing wasn't on the cake, it is now. Take a bow, Jordan Ruffhead.
I think we ended that game 66-1 for the flag.
Yeah.
So
I remember that night. I was calling that game and we took a talkback caller and we were talking about what was going to happen in the finals. And a Bulldog supporter rang up and said, I reckon we can go all the way. And we're sitting in the box going, what's this bloke on? And that was the attitude at the time. You couldn't even entertain that that was going to be the case.
Yeah.
And yet, a few short weeks later.
There's one other aspect of Murph's podcast that I listened to where he said, we actually had aspirations the year before. And it's true. Like, it was remarkable to have a coach like Bevo, and we'd lost that game to Adelaide. You might remember there's some controversy about Michael Talia and game plans and
yes,
all of that sort of thing. And we navigated that as best we could. But one thing I remember about the post 2015 season and the reason that Bevo was so intense about that event and its aftermath is that he genuinely believed we were a chance to win the flag in 2015. And Adelaide played and lost to Hawthorn in the following week, and I swear he had Hawthorn in his sights. I reckon he believed we could get past them. I think they went on to win it that year. He had been, of course, both as an amateur and in his AFL assistant coaching career, pretty much in the grand final every single year. It was just his expectation of himself. So I guess in one sense it was no surprise that he went on and got us through those four finals the following year.
Hope you're enjoying our chat with the Western Bulldogs president, Peter Gordon, and there's plenty more still to come on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying our chat with the Western Bulldogs president, Peter Gordon, on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
The local paper said, keep the dream alive. Well, it's been a nightmare for the West Coast Eagles, but the Western Bulldogs have been simply magnificent. The Eagles bow out and the Dogs live to fight another day in the semi-finals.
So I've spoken about the game in Perth. The game the week after, probably not a lot of people recollect, but the one after that, people recollect. And Murph spoke about it in his chat.
You don't want to talk about Liam Pickens' three goals against Hawthorn in front of 87,000 people?
Well, I do, Pete, but
Marcus
unfortunately,
we're stitching up Luke Hodge a couple of times.
We're already 3 hours over in a one-hour program. It's a bit like World of Sport in the old days. We used to be half an hour late after 15 minutes of World of Sport.
At least I'll get the Don Smallgoods.
No, the Bataki.
That's
the
right.
The Bataki hams. Let's go to that preliminary final, that night, that famous night where there were 25,000 people in, I think, and most of them were Bulldogs. It was extraordinary.
It was amazing. We had a promotion at the at the club where we gave them a voucher for a meal when they crossed the border from Bevo, which was kind of a nice gesture that the club didn't get a lot of positive feedback from them. But the number of people actually made the effort to drive up there as a family were extraordinary. I think Leon Cameron, who was, of course, the Giants coach for the night, tells a good story about walking out and hearing the boos for his team, the home team, and the cheers for us, and saying to his assistant, "What the hell is going on here? This is meant to be our home game." And yeah, it's a fair testament to the Bulldog spirit, isn't it, that so many of us were prepared to make that trip.
And it went right down to the wire. It was the last seconds, basically, where it was decided and a mark 20 metres out from goal before the siren sounds, and then the realisation sets in.
I can truthfully say, Peter, I still get nervous watching the replay of that game.
I don't blame you.
I mean, we've seen many great games, many great last quarters, many, many close games, but there was a sense there that there's not a single player on either team that was prepared to leave anything in the bank in relation to that. It was absolute desperation on both sides, and people throwing themselves at the ball and without any sort of fear or regard to their own safety. And yeah, two clubs, one an emerging club that had only just entered the competition and with expectations, and the Bulldog faithful, who, as you say, were the predominant part of the crowd, who had been through seven or eight losing preliminary finals, never seen a grand final in their lifetime, were on this kind of mission, and it was down to the wire. Like, 97 was a close game where we'd sort of stumbled after being about five goals in front, but that game was always close, and it was dead set level with 3 or 4 minutes to go. And there were spectacular things going. You know, Clay Smith clash of bodies with Ryan Griffin in that last in the third quarter, leading to Caleb Daniel getting a goal that just dragged us back into contention. And that incredible moment, I don't know if you remember it, where the ball spills free on our half-back line and Jason Johannesson grabs the ball, weaves through the pass.
Yes.
And all of a sudden people look up the field and Marcus Bontempelli is by himself at centre-half forward. Mm-hmm. Gets the ball, runs in, one bounce, and we draw level. I mean, I was hiding in the change rooms with a couple of minutes to go when Billy Hector, our doorman, Bill and his father Norm have been dormant at the Bulldogs for the last 90 years in total. And and he dragged me out to say, "I know you're too scared to watch this, but Jackson McRae's marked and is kicking for goal. There's a minute left." So I'm always grateful to Billy that he dragged me out for that. But it meant more to me, I think it's fair to say, without disparaging the following week, that game meant more to me than the following week, because in my lifetime of, including, you know, what, 14, 15 years as president, but a lifetime of support, I'd never seen my team in the grand final. Like, grand final week is a week for other clubs. It's a week for the Collingwoods and the St Kildas and the Geelongs. And Bulldog people had become used to the idea that that's just a world that we don't belong to and that doesn't belong to us. So in those seconds after the final siren, to actually understand that that had come to an end, that whatever happened the following week, this week the Bulldogs were in the grand final, was a moment that I just couldn't cope with. Like, I was weeping in the change rooms. I was just emotional about it in a way that I'd never been about footy, you know, before or since, or almost about anything really. And I've come across a large number of Bulldog people who feel the same way about it. Thrilled by the premiership win, but to actually have made it to the grand final. And yeah, I remember that grand final week, and I had a friend, I had a business partner who lives in LA, and he'd come out for the grand final. I decided to take the walk on the Friday before, the day before the grand final, to see him. He was staying at Crown. I walked down Bridge Road, and as I got to past the MCG, I'd completely forgotten that there was some kind of grand final parade type thing. And then all of a sudden, from everywhere, there's red, white and blue people converging. By the time I got to see it on the TV screen, there's 200,000 people there. It was just an amazing week. And I'm glad that Bulldog people got to experience that in their lifetime.
Were you happy to welcome everybody else onto the bandwagon that week? Because it was one of those rare occasions where everybody apart from the other team supporters were Bulldog supporters that week and that day.
Yeah. You know, I talked to Peggy O'Neill about this after 2018, but it was what was amazing for me in the weeks and months afterwards are the number of people who came up to me. You know, for example, at the launch of AFLW season for 2017 was in North Melbourne, and I was walking back into the city from that, and I met someone who said, "Look, I just want you to know my dad was a Bulldog supporter, and they just died," and I said, "I'm really sorry to hear that." She said, no, I'm not telling you that because I want you to know he died a happy man because of what happened. And there were so many people who would, and I talked to John Schultz about this too, with Marcus Bontempelli or Bevo, they want to talk about the game or they want to get the autograph or whatever. But with people like me or John Schultz, and I think with Peggy as well, people want to share their stories. They want to share their Bulldog connection. And whether it's the grandfather who died a year later, or whether it's the grandmother who died 5 years before but who always dreamed of that day, there's something really profound about footy in the lives of people. That moment of after a 62-year drought, that it means something really special to them, and they want to be able to convey it to someone connected with the club who they think might share that kind of that sense of the importance of it and the, you know, the family nature of it and the cultural history part of it, I guess.
You win the flag. Did it cross your mind, how are we going to top this? How could anything ever be better than this? Because we all need motivation. We all need to have something to strive for. But when you achieve something like that, which is the equivalent, the football equivalent of climbing Everest, surely there's only one way you can go after that.
No, there's a number of ways you can go, I think.
It proved to be, perhaps, that, do you think it's fair comment to say that the attitude perhaps pervaded the playing group, that they had achieved the greatest thing they were ever going to achieve in their life, and that was the reason for the drop away the next year? Would that be fair?
I don't know what's fair and what's not. I'm not trying to be defensive. I'm not trying to duck the question. I remember finding an article and showing it to my board, and it was an article that said Bulldogs have just won the flag, and with the playing group that they've got, the profile, the youth, the opportunities, we can expect that this year we'll go back-to-back and maybe even the year after that. And I showed it to him and said, when do you reckon that was written? And you know, who's written that? And it was actually written, I think, in February 1955, the year after we won our first flag. And historically, we look back on 1954 and think, well, we really stuffed the opportunity. The club didn't go anywhere after that. And a lot of people after 2016 said, well, you know, we don't want to go that way. And I certainly felt that way. We've had a couple of, you know, indifferent years on the field since then. And there've been a, you know, a lot of, I guess there's been a bit of bad press about premiership hangovers and things like that. I tend to avoid that sort of talk myself. I think you do the best that you can. I think people react to it in different ways. I heard it said, I think even on this radio station, you know, that from the president down, people are drinking their own bathwater and stuff like that. I was ironically amused by it because in the week that it was said, I had just got back from Mexico where I'd gone to negotiate with Mission Foods, our major sponsor, a deal to allow Mercedes-Benz vans to come in and be our back sponsor. We were thrilled to get Mercedes-Benz vans as a sponsor. I mean, the idea for the Footscray Football Club being having a partnership with a company as prestigious as Mercedes-Benz vans was a real thing for us. But it was a few days of my time, and it was a bit of arm twisting and delicate negotiations. And I was doing my job. A lot of people were doing their job. I think a lot of people did get overly focused on how much credit am I getting for the job, the role that I played, whatever their role was. So I think there are bits and pieces of that. I think that, you know, it's also important to recognise we finished seventh at the end of the home and away season in 2016, and courtesy of a whole lot of things, some great medical management, some great contributions from the players, some extraordinary coaching and vision, some great leadership from Murph and from Bevo, we had a magnificent September of 2016. We're only a couple of wins away from being in the identical position in 2017. And, you know, it's been 2 years since then. So, I hope I feel like I'm ducking the question. I think these things are complex.
Well, I don't think there's a definitive answer to it, but yeah. It's good to get your take on it.
Yeah.
How often do you watch it back?
Oh, it's been a long time now. I watched it. I've watched the last quarter of the preliminary final a lot. Still get nervous when I watch it. I think I watched a fair few of the Liam Picken highlight reels in the week that Liam announced his retirement because, yeah, you know, I admire him so much as a person and a player, but in particular, in what really is an extraordinary last quarter of a grand final, his last quarter in that grand final is extraordinary. There's that incredible passage of chaotic play where I think Shane Biggs blocks the ball about seven times in about 30 seconds, where eventually Jack McRae centres the ball. It ends up in Liam's hands and he kicks that clutch goal. And there's another moment where he takes a mark so reminiscent of his father, Billy.
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I was calling at the time.
Okay, yeah. Respectfully, I remember the Dennis Cometti.
Oh, yes. Call. Well, you wouldn't have
Picking
heard.
From behind.
Yeah.
Picking from behind. And, you know, we are, you know, beyond saddened that Liam's career finishes on 198 games, but no one could imagine having a better highlight reel or a better contribution to the club. I have hanging on my wall at the office a picture of him, picture taken from behind as he kicked the winning goal. So I don't know if you remember that, but he's in a contest at the goal square. Wrongfoot's the Sydney Swans guy who finishes on the ground, and he gets to run into the goal from the 10-metre square. In front of him are the Bulldog faithful, who have had 2 or 3 seconds to understand that he's running in to kick a goal from the goal line, which will nail the grand final. And all of their arms are up and all of their smiles are of delight and their mouths are open. And I said at a presentation to him at the club just a couple of weeks ago that I love that photo both because it's an important part of his history, Bulldog history, grand final history, AFL history. But I love it for another reason, and that's because it symbolises the impact that he had on Bulldog supporters and the club. As a consequence of him, that's the reaction that supporters have. And every now and then you'll get a bit of football photography that'll capture a moment like no other. That's a wonderful photograph.
Great to have you with us for this very special feature episode with Peter Gordon, the Western Bulldogs president, on This Is Your Sporting Life. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives, back with more after the break.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying what is a fascinating chat with Peter Gordon, the Bulldogs president, on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. For all of the reasons you've just so beautifully described, it seems impossible to think that you could have a moment that might even come close to matching that. But the AFLW Premiership is something that is very dear to your heart.
Yeah, look, I have two daughters, and the way that they now think about football is different because of AFLW. My daughter Maddie is making plans to play with her team next year. I've seen girls around the club really since I've been a boy there myself, really. But I think that they think about the game in a different way, and they aspire not just to be people who watch, but people who play. I've seen girls like Bridie Garlick, Simon Garlick's daughter, who he says was a much better junior prospect than either of his two boys, but who used to say, you know, when will it be, Dad, that I'll have to give this game away because girls don't get to play. So I think it's been one of the great, really, injustices of our sporting history that it's taken so long. And I think I'll say in particular as men, but I think also as a community have misunderstood that there's been this really deep aspiration for women to be able to play the game. I'm really thrilled by the way that it's improving in terms of quality. We're seeing athletes now who can kick longer, be more agile, take marks. Yeah, so some of the vision of Taylor Harris, both marking and kicking the ball, you know, is every bit as inspiring as Alex Jesolinko or Ted Whitten wrapped up in the one player. So I'm thrilled that we've taken a leadership role with that. I'm really hopeful for its future. It's going to have its ups and downs, of course. It's becoming a much more competitive environment. We've lost a few players in the postseason, both this year and last year. Of course, we lost Emma Carney, best and fairest winner. We look like losing Monique Conti this year as well. But you've kind of got to, when you're a leader in the competition, and the Bulldogs have been a leader in this space, you've got to suck it up. Because if you believe in an AFLW competition, then you've got to believe that it's got to expand to embrace more clubs and more of the community. And those clubs have to be competitive. And in a limited talent pool, it means that you've got to be prepared to have a system that shares that talent around. So what's exciting from our point of view is that as we lose those players, we have an opportunity from the vast number of young athletes who are now joining into the ranks and are available to be drafted. It's such a richer talent pool. So I'm looking forward to replacing the women who are leaving with younger players who get their opportunity as well. It's a great time to be involved in footy.
Does part of the way that we appreciate the women's game, Pete, stem that people have to stop making comparisons between the men's game and the women's game and trying to say, well, someone jumps higher, someone runs faster, all that sort of thing? If you made that comparison, nobody would ever turn up to watch Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce, who was a brilliant sprinter, because she doesn't run as fast as Usain Bolt. But she's the best that we have in her sphere. Is that what we need to do to differentiate between the men's and the women's games and not constantly compare?
Look, I think first of all, it's a game for the players, and so if players enjoy it, and then you know that's an end in itself. And I think it's then in the eye of the beholder. I don't know a lot of tennis fans, for example, who really love the men's game but won't, you know, cross the street to watch a women's game. But if that's what floats their boat, then you know I don't seek to interfere with that. I love the women's game because it's a great spectacle and is improving as a spectacle all the time. But I also love it because it's incredibly energising and inspiring, really, to see a generation of women and girls who've never had the opportunity before all of a sudden making a league of their own. And to actually be, as a club now, responsible for negotiating with players as they want to leave, and you know, You can get a little bit too focused on, you know, the ins and outs of those sort of negotiations, like you do with the men players. The fact that it's actually reached that level of professionalism where people are concerned about their careers and sporting contracts and sponsorship contracts and all of that sort of thing, every now and then you sort of just lean back and sort of say, you know what, that in itself is a landmark. It's getting to a level of professionalism where there's this sort of contention and wheeling and dealing between clubs, etc. So, yeah, you know, the right way to look at it, I think, is it's one more landmark in a competition that I think certainly for, you know, you think about Gil McLaughlin's tenure as CEO of the AFL, it's the standout achievement in an era. Like, I think he's championed competitive balance, you know, great stadium deals, growth in the competition, community footy. But women's football is something that he advanced, I think, at least 5 years ahead of where it was going. And it's had its challenges, you know, with so many teams wanting to come in, with so many existing teams wanting to protect their fiefdom, with the need to sort of balance when it starts, because the Australian Open is itself so ubiquitous in January, and there's a need to protect it a little bit from, you know, there's a sort of hype that goes along with the start of the men's season. I think it's grown in a spectacular way, and I'm really happy that during my tenure as president of the Bulldogs, I've got to participate in that as well. So, you know, I've got great memories of the men's premiership. I've got great memories of the women's premiership, a couple of VFL premierships. You know, I've had a good time with the Bulldogs.
Hope you're enjoying the chat with Peter Gordon, the Western Bulldogs president. You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Our final segment with Peter Gordon on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Where do we sit in the expansion of the game? Because they say that if you're standing still, you're going backwards. Is there room for the game to expand?
Well, look, I think that this is a really important question. And I was quoted in the Herald Sun a few weeks ago as saying that I think there should be a team in Tasmania. And let me just go through a few ideas behind that idea. The AFL job is not just to make money. It's a not-for-profit. Its essential core mission is to be a keeper of the code and a builder of the game. And Tasmania has such a rich history in AFL football. You know, think of the Peter Hudsons and the Darryl Baldocks, and you know, it's fine, it's good, and it's appropriate to build into the northern markets in Queensland and New South Wales. I'm thoroughly behind that and support it as much as possible. But Tasmania, I think has the right from a cultural and a heritage point of view, and from the point of view of best assisting the growth of community football at a local level. I've heard Jeff Kennett talk about the economic irrationality of doing it. Let's just go over a few figures. If you don't, it probably costs to run a lower echelon economically AFL club probably costs $40 to $43 million a year, of which about half is AFL dividend figures. I think the AFL made an operating profit of above $30 million that year. So if they can't configure a way to get an extra dividend that works across a 19th club, I'd be very, very surprised. That means that you take that out. The Tasmanian franchise, if I can use that economic term, needs to find about $20 million to make ends meet. There's already, you know, several million dollars in major sponsorship that the state of Tasmania itself has demonstrated it is prepared to put in to a club. One imagines if there was a Tasmanian club, it would go to that Tasmanian club. Then you've got all of the Tasmanian corporates that are currently around. I think there are something like 90,000 people in Tasmania who are members of AFL clubs. So when you look at the other revenue streams that support other clubs, whether they're corporate sponsorships, memberships, coteries, food and beverage for the home games, etc., and the other key revenue streams, I don't have any doubt that that the Tasmanian economy could support a Tasmanian club. I think that the argument that it's economically irrational to think of a Tasmanian team is quite simply wrong. And I think that when you look at other great competitions around the world, you know, Major League Baseball, the NBA, you know, they're quite comfortable with the idea of expanding and having, you know, upwards of 25, 26, 30 teams in the competition. So I start with the premise that I think that Tasmania has earned the right to a club. I don't think the only criterion should be, does it make more money? But if it's a relevant criterion, then I think that there's a plausible case to say that it isn't going to cost money to the competition.
Where's the club based? That's the problem. That's one of the problems, isn't it? Because we know that the unofficial civil war goes on the island between north and south.
Yep.
Where do you base the club?
I think those are matters for Tasmanian people. And I haven't entered into this debate because I presume to be a Tasmanian expert. I am concerned to make the argument that because the only people who speak about this tend to say, well, of course, it's ridiculous to suggest that Tasmania could ever afford or justify economically its own club. I think there's another argument that can be made there, and I've just tried to make it. I think as a matter of fundamental policy, we need to understand that the AFL is not BHP. It's not there to return increased shareholder dividends every year. It's there to grow the game, to respect the game, and to be keepers of the code, and there's an imperative in relation to that. I think it's a fair question, and I think the answer either is they're in Hobart or they're in Hobart and Launceston. And I choose to leave that to people who I have no doubt that a Tasmanian team will come, and I think that that'll be one of the confronting questions that they'll need to debate. A good thing is that there are already a couple of grounds.
The AFL have often stated that they don't want to buy. They don't want an odd number of teams in the competition. Is that, do you think, a realistic stumbling block? Can that be put up as a reason not to have a team in Tassie?
No, I don't. I think that a buy increasingly ought to be considered a rotating buy as a health and safety issue for players, as a rehab issue for players. I can't see any problem. We already have 8-day breaks, 10-day breaks, elongated breaks, as well as buys written into the program, and a buy at the end of the season. I just don't see it as a first magnitude issue.
Thanks for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Peter. I've enjoyed the time a lot.
It's been a pleasure. Peter Gordon joining us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. We'll be back same time next week. Hope you can join us then.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.